So I'm going to be talking about, you know, what the privacy requires to randomness, joint work with Carl Bosley. So I'd like to thank Amit Sahai and Salil Wadan for some very useful suggestions after the paper initially came out. All right, so randomness is important. It's important in not just in computer science, but in many aspects, like in business transactions, for example. It's very important to sometimes make decisions in a randomized manner. It's not just like in business, for example, in everyday life, also kind of could come handy from time to time. So essentially, we will be kind of asking, in this talk, I guess we will be asking a little bit more boring kind of thing about randomness in cryptography. So in any event, the reasons are much less interesting, but secret keys must have entropy, because if there is no entropy, there are no secrets, everybody knows everything, and it's not interesting. Many primitives like encryption, commitment, zero knowledge must be randomized anyway, exactly for the purposes of achieving privacy, irrespective of the keys. And of course, the common abstraction is that we have some perfect randomness, but this is a strong assumption. It's kind of hard to get truly ideal perfect randomness. For example, you might want to try to implement a pseudorandom generator, but it might be hard to get. And as I said, here you cannot even verify if the randomness is not good. So somebody can kind of just implement something bad, and you will never know. Or maybe you would, but you wouldn't be able to prove it in court. And coins cannot be trusted as well. So for example, you can bet your life on 100 flips that 100 flips of a coin will be random, but there are some events which you don't expect, and maybe they happen. So you can start to believe in some magical things if you have a bad source of randomness, things like that. So that's my question for this talk. Whether we are done now or not. But things become even worse if you start to talk about active attackers, as is illustrated here. So these two guys kind of decided to flip a coin, and there was this active attacker who picked the outcome of the coin. So essentially, the existence of randomness is a non-trivial assumption. We kind of assume it for granted, but it's kind of not obvious. So in particular, as you just saw, speaking about perfect randomness, it's hard to get. And so you might ask the question, given all those problems that we saw on the last slides, do we really need perfect randomness? Maybe we can deal with weak assumptions. And indeed, people have asked it a long time ago. So they said, maybe, I need to have some kind of source of randomness, because otherwise I cannot do anything, at least in cryptography. But maybe it comes from some nature, maybe it comes from some, decisions of some CPU or whatever it is. So we'll assume that it has some entropy, but we don't know exactly what it is, but we can assume, the CPO stayed on the job for a few years, probably he made some money or something, so we can assume some kind of property of the source. So more formally, perfect source is just a family of distributions that is finding some property, and hopefully you want to assume the minimal property possible. As I just said, the very minimal property is that the source has entropy, because otherwise nothing could be done. But you can assume maybe some more structured sources. And what does that mean to tolerate an imperfect source? It means that you want to have kind of one scheme, you want to design one carefully designed scheme, such that it will work for any distributions from the source. Because presumably that's the whole point, you don't know more about the source other than it has some properties, so you want to have something which kind of works for all distributions. And if it doesn't, maybe you want to get a better source or assume more or something like that. So the main question that we are going to be studying, and of course it has been a lot of work, as I'll briefly illustrate, the question is which imperfect sources are enough for cryptography. The first obvious answer is, well, you don't need to just have a perfect randomness. So there is this family of extractable sources, which are sources permitting deterministic extraction of nearly perfect randomness. I'm not sure what is this. That's a pointer, pretty cool. If you have a source such that you can just apply some von Neumann coin or something like that, such that you can apply deterministic extraction, then you can just, whatever you develop in cryptography for perfect randomness, in most of the cases just carries through and you are done. Unfortunately, many sources are non-extractable, and of course, Yuval will say in reality, you just apply SHA-1 to anything, and it would be good, so that's fine. It's not theoretically maybe sound, but in practice, we are theoreticians, so I guess you can have true randomness, or assume you have true randomness, but certainly in theory, many sources are not extractable, and that was observed, back in 86 by Santa Vazirani, and in fact they didn't just observe it for the general entropy source, but for very, very restrictive entropy source. Doesn't really matter what it is. So the point is many sources are not extractable. So it's natural to see, do we really need kind of true randomness for cryptography? Are extractable, more specifically, are extractable sources the only good sources for cryptography? And the answer is actually that's kind of another degree of variability. Cryptography is not just kind of one thing. There are many kind of aspects of cryptography. Different aspects might require different usages of randomness. So let's see what we know right now. So for correctness soundness, which I kind of generously view as part of cryptography, even though it's, historically it's more maybe in complexity theory. But if you just want to ensure that somebody doesn't lie by like challenging them randomly or just whatever, checking that, the algorithm works. There's a classical question is how to de-randomize BBP, almost not de-randomize, but how to base, let's say, the class BBP on, weak randomness rather than imperfect random sources. And here you don't need randomness kind of inherently to solve the problem. You can run exponential time and solve the problem, but conceivably it's a big open question whether it gives you speed up or not, but conceivably it could bring you some speed up. So in the celebrated lines of work, the kind of probably the punctuating point is the paper with Luca as one of the co-authors. Kind of they showed that BBP can really be based on very, very, I think it's Andoni, Clementi, Rolleman, maybe Trevisan. They showed that very, very big sources can be tolerated. And you can ask similar question about even more general classes like interactive protocols where the verifier needs to have randomness and you can conceivably prove all languages in P space. And even here, it's pretty using modern machinery. I mean, we had to work much less on those guys because between these years, some nice machinery was developed. But essentially, even for interactive protocols, you can base them on extremely, extremely big sources and in fact for minimal kind of sources, which just have entropy. So this is a celebrated thing. So this is the way usually no comes with unhappy face hits. No refers to the question, do we need perfect randomness? Well, the answer is no, so that's a good news. Authentication and predictability, that's more kind of, I guess, cryptographic. So you want to build some kind of digital signatures, authenticate messages, etc. So here it's not completely kind of the weakest possible sources, but quite weak sources are enough, for example, for Max. So those of you who came to Leo's talk, for example, he kind of mentioned the paper of Maurer Wolf, and probably this thing goes even back to some things. But essentially, pretty, as long as you have a source of, non-trivial entropy rate, in this case, a half, you can build max, and for interactive max, you can even tolerate any constant fraction of entropy. So you can do quite non-trivial things. Under strong, well, necessarily strong, but still reasonable assumption, you can even build digital signature, let's say, assuming strong one-way permutations. Well, I should put, of course, I forgot to put Noor-Yang. Essentially, we just take Noor-Yang construction. It's just like one minor tweak extended to this setting, assuming, some stronger notion of one-way permutations. And, for general sources, again, meaning not necessarily just entropy sources, because entropy is the most desirable sources, but we have very strong separations. As a kind of footnote in our paper with Joel Spencer, we kind of showed very, very strong separation for all entropy levels between authentication and extraction. So authentication certainly doesn't need extraction. It's kind of not surprising that you just need that something is kind of hard to do. So as long as you have enough entropy, it's enough.
What is general sources?
Not necessarily entropy sources. Entropy sources just means the most general source. Entropy sources means the source, but the only thing you know about the source that has entropy, and general sources, maybe you have some more structure. It doesn't really matter. All right? It doesn't matter. All right.
So, not structure, but not entropy?
It doesn't matter. Okay, so point of this thing is, the point of the thing is, you certainly for correctness, soundness, authentication, and predictability, you don't need true randomness. All right? So what are the certain things that we have in cryptography? Privacy and distinguishability. In fact, presumably many people identify, you know, like encryption, you know, with cryptography. So there are mixed indications so far. So certainly all known techniques, like positive techniques, well, not surprisingly, people abstract away details that you consider unnecessary, like imperfect randomness, but all known techniques, including like pseudo-randomness and things like that, critically rely on perfect randomness, at least some of them, like, for example, sample the seed, Goldrich-Levenbit, all those beautiful theorems, of course, they use perfect randomness. And that's a very nice series of two works, but you know, the nice part refers to the paper of McInnes and Pincus, which is probably a little bit less, not very well known, so I want to kind of point this out. So static non-extractable sources, for example, all those kinds of like, and, you know, more and more structured entropy sources. So, you know, natural kind of static non-extractable sources are not enough for privacy as well. I mean, this is kind of a little bit weird, but they're not enough even to build, you know, just kind of symmetric encryption. And in this paper a few years back with Shenzhen, Manoj, and Amit, we kind of, you know, extended it to computational encryption, to, you know, commitment, zero knowledge, and anything you want. So essentially, the studied, even the weakest non-extractable sources are not enough for privacy as well. So these are kind of two negative indications. So it kind of says, well, unfortunately, it looks like you might need perfect randomness. So there is a positive indication, primarily, I guess, in my paper with Joel Spencer, and then we later did something for secret sharing Bartosz Pradatik and Krzysztof Petrzak from last TCC. So essentially, we looked at kind of, we wanted to restrict our attention to the simplest possible case, like one-bit symmetric encryption. People share a key coming from, let's say, a big source, and let's say they want to do symmetric encryption. Homogeneously, they want to kind of share a one-bit using, let's say, two out of two secret sharing scheme. So there, we actually showed it's kind of trivial that if you can extract one bit, you can do a one-time pad of one bit, and if you can do encryption, you can do two out of two secret sharing. One share is a ciphertext, the other share is a key that you decrypt the ciphertext. And this application is showed the S-trick, and the S-trick in a very strong sense, which I don't want to get into, but essentially it's really, really a non-implication in the other direction. So specifically, let's say, concentrating on this part, in order to encrypt one bit, you don't necessarily need sources which extract one bit, for example. But of course, this is kind of a very, very limited thing, who encrypts one bit. So the interesting question is, what about general kind of multi-bit case? You know, what if you can encrypt whatever, some number of bits, etc. So, and I come to our main result. So as Adam told me, so Cynthia Dvorak told him that she likes talks where after, you know, very few minutes you see the point of the talk, so you can just leave, or, you know, the projector goes down. So if the projector doesn't go down at the end of this slide, you will know the main point of what I'm going to say, and then we're going to feel...
then we can leave.
All right. So the main result is kind of a negative result that, unfortunately, near perfect randomness seems to be inherent for information theoretic private key encryption. We'll see some extensions later. So this is kind of a negative result. So more specifically, though, I'm going to show a much more formal theorem. So right now, just get the fuzzy, I guess, feeling about the result, and then I'll put all epsilon and deltas and whatever you need. You can get a preview on that side of the board. But essentially, the first theorem, it says that if you have an n-bit source, imperfect source, which admits a good b-bit encryption. So, you know, using kind of n-bit key, you can encrypt, let's say, b-bits, where b is, you know, slightly non-trivial, so we're not going to run some kind of trivial little kind of operations. Then one can deterministically extract nearly b bits, extract nearly b nearly perfect bits from the source. So in other words, if you have a source, you don't know anything about it, the only thing you know is that it can encrypt b bits, it must be the case that you can extract nearly b bits, and I'll interpret the theorem on the next slide. This is just kind of an idea. And another little optimization is that also if the encryption scheme is efficient, polynomial in this case in n, then we can ensure that the extraction is efficient as well, so it kind of preserves efficiency. And the second result is, this is the main result, the second result is much more difficult to prove, but than the first one, as you will see, but it shows the tightness of the first result. So we give kind of an example that this essential restriction is necessary. There are non-extractable n-bit sources admitting a perfect encryption of essentially log n bits. So the encryption is, so even if you have a perfect encryption of up to this many bits, you cannot extract even one bit. So this is a thing, so how to interpret those two results?
Yeah,
I'm interpreting them, okay, fine, let me take a look, yeah, sure. But I'm going to go to back to these theorems and interpret them in the next two slides, but take a look. So essentially, encryption of B bits.
We wanted to dig after this.
So encryption of B bits implies extraction of nearly B bits as long as B is non-trivial. And so let me interpret it. I'm repeating this theorem on the full slide theorem one and the next full slide theorem two. Okay. So to encrypt B bits, it says that either the secret key must be exponential well in B, right? Either you need to have a source which is exponential this, or S is extractable and in fact perfect enough to apply, well, essentially a B bit one type S. So you will lose a few bits from B, you wouldn't be able to encrypt exactly B bits, but something very, very close to B bits. And so in particular, kind of, if B is non-trivial, you know, unless you're talking about encryption of like one or two bits or like log whatever small number, if B is kind of a non-trivial number like 200 bits, two to the 200 is infeasible, so you just cannot even physically maybe sample, you know, an exponentially long key. In this case, you're stuck with this scenario. So you're stuck with the case that you must find a source capable of extracting almost B random bits to begin with. And then, of course, there is some loss of efficiency, but still, you might as well kind of, if you like simplicity, you might as well maybe first extract almost B bits and use a one-time pad.
What's the issue with the information theoretic?
This result is right now, so in two more slides I'll tell you what extraction. So not just information theoretic encryption. Me and you share a key which comes from a big source and we want to encrypt this thing. So I will talk about efficiency implications in a second. And, this is kind of a joke, maybe very few people will appreciate it, but so one-time pair is universal after all. Salil is probably the only one who can appreciate it, but essentially, the previous paper with Spencer, we showed this separation. It was called on the non-universality of the one-time pad. So because, you know, we kind of interpret those results for one bit, that one-time pad is not universal, don't necessarily need to do a one-time pad. And in fact, we kind of wanted to initially maybe name the paper on the universality of the one-time pad. Then I kind of thought a little bit and said, well, whom am I making fun of? And then I just realized that maybe I should give a more generic and also more informative title. So anyway, so one-time pad is to some extent universal. So what about theorem two? It kind of gives you some glimmer of hope. There is kind of an unclear fish because, you know, essentially it's such a great hope, but it just says that encryption of 5 to log n, essentially log n bits, doesn't imply extraction of one bit. And this somewhat non-trivially extends, even though the results are orthogonal, but I don't want to talk about why they're orthogonal.
But this is where I got confused, the first point of theorem two. Before you said if you can encrypt B bits, you can extract B bits.
As long as B is more than log n, provided B is more log n. So what's the precondition of the theorem? There was a precondition here that B is greater than log n. So, because it just says, for theorem one, because it just says that, you know, B is greater than log n, so it means that n is less than 2 to the B, I guess. So it just says that if either n is greater than 2 to the b, in which case, well, I'm not saying anything, but you're stuck with some very inefficient scheme, or if n is less, then our results kind of show that you must be able to extract. So it trivially extends the one-bit separation of Donis and Spencer to these things, and I don't know about the time, but we'll see. I'm hoping to give you an idea of this. This is my favorite theorem in the talk, but maybe I'll just give you essentially a simple proof from Doris Spencer and give you hints how to extend it to this case. So, but essentially for encrypting very few bits, true randomness is not inherent. That's kind of the picture. So here are some of the extensions to answer, I think, Tal's question about computational. So for computational security, it's easy to see, we didn't put on the paper, but it was pointed by Salil Amit and several other people, that it's easy to see that if you have a computationally secure encryption, which is putting computation all everywhere, it implies extraction. Oh, that's not good. So it implies, so the projector, I guess, went down and everything starts to break here. But you got the punchline, so almost just the extensions. So encryption of bits, computational encryption of bits implies extraction of pseudorandom bits. But one kind of point, it certainly implies extraction, let's say, of at least one statistically good bit. Because for computational security of many bits, every individual bit has to be statistically secure. So even in this case, you do get necessity to extract at least one statistical bit, and probably even like super whatever logarithmic insecurity parameter or something. And also efficiency, we kind of see is that if you have a polynomial time encryption, it will show the existence of polynomial time extraction, even though it will be somewhat non-explicit. More or less, we'll just pick a random efficient function from some family of efficient functions, and we show this overwhelming probability is going to be a good extractor. You interpret it positive and negative, so I'm giving you an official way to sample the function such that there's very high probability of sure it's good, but of course, where do you sample it? You need randomness to sample it, and so on. But non-uniformly, let's say, it certainly is the existence of efficient encryption implies the existence of efficient extraction. And again, just examining the proof, you can easily see that the only thing we need here is binding, so it extends to public key encryption and perfectly binding commitment, but not yet other primitives. All right, so what are the conclusions of this part? I do have, it's not a short talk, so just in case you want to, but I will do conclusions now, because things will become a little bit more technical after that. So one time pair is universal for private key encryption, strong indications that nearly perfect randomness is inherent for privacy. So there are some nice open questions, like this de-randomize this, non-uniform construction of extractor, extend it to all privacy applications. Maybe I'm just thinking it would be nice to get somewhat more general thing, like in the other paper about the fact that known non-extractable sources are not enough for cryptography. We had just one general result which can just immediately apply to all kinds of settings. It would be very nice to try to maybe, if it is true, try to extend our approach to kind of something, very general, and more generally, it's nice to classify cryptographic applications with respect to their utilization of randomness, just so that we can really understand what is going on. Any questions?
What do you mean by de-randomized construction?
Well, as I said, it would be nice to have you give me an encryption, maybe using Oracle access to encryption or something like that. I call it a few times and a few messages or something, and I can just say, okay, this is a good extraction. So.
But didn't you say that the theorem said that there was a deterministic?
Well, there is a deterministic extraction, but we showed that if there exists a good encryption, there exists good extraction. But there is a question of, is it explicit how to find it? So we have a randomized way to find it. So it's a randomized procedure, but it's high probability that it's a particular thing, which is good. But it would be nice to make explicit the way to find this procedure. It seems it's somewhat hopeless, So maybe. To Salil, in today's Salil will come up with.
So then it's a technicality in the proof.
It just would be nice. So you're right. If you know a specific scheme, probably there is some good analyst. He'll say, okay, now I know it exists, and you can do it. So if you have perfect randomness on the side, you can with very high probability sample it.
So
I agree.
You already have an encryption scheme. What do you care about de-randomizing it and giving it?
Yeah, it's not that I care to get one to pair, but maybe I want to randomize, I want to extract randomness for other applications. So it's a philosophical question, I think the result is strong enough, but there is a way to strengthen it further.
I don't think I get this relation either. So what happens if we have a non-linear extractor, right?
Well, the extractor is, once I fix it, so essentially given an encryption, I give you either an efficient probabilistic procedure or non-uniform procedure. You pick once and for all. So once you pick it, with very high probability it's good, you fix it for all, it's efficient.
Maybe it'll be helpful to remind the order quantifiers on the distribution. You have this family distribution.
Oh, right. Okay. Okay, so maybe a good way. So you're getting into some technicality, so let me address this technicality before moving. So essentially the order of quantifiers is the following. So we're given some source of randomness, and the only thing we know about the source that it has a good encryption scheme. So there exists a good encryption scheme such that for any distribution in the family, whatever, this is a good encryption scheme. So based on that, we have a probabilistic procedure on the side. You know, you take your encryption scheme and you give a probabilistic procedure to output a fixed polynomial time extractor. So a fixed polynomial time guy that goes from n bits and extracts almost b bits. So this procedure is probabilistic or non-uniform either way. So you can criticize this part. So once this procedure finishes, it outputs a particular guy sided with all but exponentially high probability. This particular guy is a good deterministic extractor for any distribution in the family. So this particular guy works for any one of these things. Essentially.
You have a seeded extractor.
Sir?
You have a seeded extractor?
No, it's not a seeded extractor, that's the point. So I choose extractor once, I fix it, and now it works for all distributions. As opposed to first give the distribution and then choose a seed. Yeah.
So maybe you should be clear that when you say source,
it's a family of distributions.
Family of distributions, and when other people say source, sometimes they mean a distribution.
Right. Yeah, I was clear. I can go 7 slides back and I'll get it. But yeah. So there is some nice, but maybe we'll see the proof and you will see some of those points will be reiterated. And the good news looks like I probably won't be able to prove theorem to anyway, but. All right. So the point is, are you guys ready to have some fun proving some explicit things? All right. So we can have some party and enjoy cakes and things like that. So. once the fun stops, you will see that in reality it's not going to be fun. It's just going to be some. Technical stuff going on. So it's essentially details, all right? I wanted to replay it, but now we're running out of time, so I think you've seen enough of this thing. So details, all right? So let's talk about deterministic extraction. So n-bit source, back to Adam's point, it's a family of distributions k on 0, 1, 2, then. I'm just for simplicity assuming it's n-bit source, but of course things generalize to all domains or whatever. So n-bit extractor, it's one procedure. Just one particular function such that it goes from n-bits and tries to extract an n-bit key. So extractor is epsilon fairy for all distributions. So one particular guy has to work for all distributions. The statistical distance between the output of the extractor and the uniform distribution is at most epsilon, as opposed to probabilistic extractor, there you kind of first give the distribution and then kind of choose a random kind of extractor from a family. So here it's a fixed one guy. So the sources, the family of the collection of distributions is L epsilon extractable if there exists an epsilon fair extractor for this source, right? So this is extraction. So what a private key encryption. So Alice and Bob share n bit key k, which comes from one of the distributions from the source. The problem is you don't know which one, you have to build an encryption scheme which is kind of good for all of them. And so what is this bit encryption scheme? It's two procedures, encryption and decryption, which kind of encryption takes a message and the key, outputs the ciphertext, decryption takes the ciphertext and the key, outputs the message. And we care about just Shannon thing, one-time security. Well, given the negative result, it makes the result only stronger. For security, it says that encryption is delta secure for all, once again, for all particular distributions on the key, because we don't know which one we're going to get. And for all messages, the statistical distance between encryption of a fixed message, and I can put encryption of other message, but just for simplicity, I can put encryption of the uniform distribution is at most delta. So for example, you cannot tell encryption of a random message from encryption of any fixed message. That's just kind of natural. And we say that the source is B delta encryptable. So those are all the letters. We will not introduce any more letters, but the source is B delta encryptable if there exists a delta secure B bit encryption scheme for this source. So now the point of these things is just to kind of clean up, to restate the results in a bit more formal term. So if you have an N bit source, which allows you to encrypt B bits with security delta, N B is non-trivial, where non-trivial is more than log N plus something which depends on epsilon, well, we can choose epsilon whatever we want. Then we claim that it must be the case that S is B minus 2 log 1 of epsilon, epsilon plus delta extractable. So it must be the case that we can deterministically extract nearly B bits as close to B as we want. Well, the price we pay is here. B has to be slightly, you know, larger than log n by this amount and a little bit here. But essentially, if delta is negligible, epsilon is kind of negligible, you get that encryption really pretty much implies extraction. You know, all the constants are here, there is no little o or whatever. So this is the restatement of theorem 1. In theorem 2, it says that for b less than log n minus log n, there exists some very artificial n-bit source S, which allows you to perfectly encrypt b bits when you be up to this number, so the error is 0. But it's not epsilon, one epsilon, but you cannot extract even one bit with fairness epsilon, where epsilon, where epsilon is essentially a half. So fairness a half is the largest possible fairness. For any distribution is at most a half far from uniform distribution on one bit. So it's really a very bad thing. So it just says that you can fix the outcome of any extractor to a constant with probability, one minus little o one. Or essentially, that's what it says. So this number is some kind of, it's not even that ugly given the generality of the result, but, you put in the particular things and you get this. So, some ugly expression. All right, so those are results restated. So let's try to, I'll give you full details of theorem one and, we'll see how far we can get in theorem two.
So, Irvine, to make sure I understand the same with theorem one, what he's saying is that for every encryption algorithm, you can construct or there exists an extractor.
Yep.
Such that for every distribution in which the encryption is secure, the extractor works.
That's actually good. As you'll see in theorem 2, that's how we restate it. I just stated it in this form, but you're right. Without losing generality, the source, given an encryption, the source will be, all distributions which it is secure. Right. So let's do proof of theorem 1. So let's define an auxiliary source. So I can fit the whole proof on one slide, but I want to really follow the UC framework, if you wish, and I will just make it very modular and expand it into two slides, okay? Maybe three slides, I forgot. So let's try to make a very modular proof, but so hopefully it will be completely clear what is going on. Okay, so...
It's
concurrent work, yeah. So... as you can see, I concurrently prove theorem 2 here and theorem 1 here. So, in any event, so let's define some auxiliary source S prime, which consists of the following. It's for all fixed keys, it encrypts uniform, it encrypts a random thing. So this is my family of distributions S prime. And here is a,
So how do you pick a member of the family? You fix a key?
Well, so you fix a key and then you pick, and then a particular distribution for this fixed key is pick a random message and encrypt a random message. So the first lemma is that if this weird and useless, seemingly useless source is L epsilon extractable, whatever L is, so if we can extract L bits out of this source, then it must be the case that my original source, which is some weird distribution, so whatever, which the encryption is secure, is L epsilon plus delta extractable. So really, the point, as we will see, the point will be to really extract randomness without loss of, it suffices to construct a good extractor for this source S prime. And in fact, you will see what the extractor is. The extractor that we construct for this source, it just takes a hypothetical extractor for S prime, or not so hypothetical as we will see, and encrypts zero under the key. So it takes a key, it encrypts zero under the key, and applies this extractor. So this is kind of the way we are going to build our extractor. Yeah. Any questions? Okay. So, and let's give a proof. It will fit on this slide. So take any particular distribution from my source, from which, so we know that all such distributions are good for encryption. That's the only thing we know about them. So then, statistical distance between the output of the extractor, of this extractor of my things, and the uniform distribution on L bits. Well, first let me expand this. This is extractor prime of encryption 0 of k. Right, this is just expanded this definition. So now, I claim that because the encryption is secure, and k, so on this distribution k, instead of encryption of zero, I can put encryption of uniform message and pay delta. Because, nobody can tell apart this thing for this probability distribution k from uniform thing. I can just pay delta and put encryption of uniform distribution. Now, essentially, I have two things random. This guy random and this guy random. So because I already have this guy random, I'll just, you know, do something, I will kind of de-randomize this using kind of brute force, essentially triangle inequality. I will say, you know, let's just condition on all possible key k. So there is some probability distribution k, I don't know anything about it, but, you know, any distribution essentially is a convex combination of singleton distributions with this weight. So because statistical distance satisfies triangle inequality, it's at most the sum of pk, statistical distance of encryption of uniform distribution under this particular key, well, and I tag along delta. So now, well, I'm essentially done. This, you know, is a particular distribution from my family, and x prime is a good extractor. It extracts something with statistical distance epsilon, right? I mean, this is my assumption that this is L epsilon extractable. So I get epsilon n. So I essentially get epsilon, sum of pk is 1, and any probability distribution, I don't care what it is. So I get epsilon and delta, and that's the end of the lemma. All right? Yeah.
So you replaced a fixed key with a, you changed the fixed key.
So I'll comment on it. So it's kind of ironic what is going on here. So in order to construct a deterministic extract, I don't have uniform distributions of mesh. I have encryption of a fixed message and random key. In the proof somehow, I kind of changed it to encryption of a uniform message because of, that's why I use security of encryption. And so I don't really have uniform message, I have a fixed message. But in the proof, I kind of replaced this. And I said, well, once I have this, I can put a fixed piece. It's kind of funny that the proof really goes, you know, fixed message random key to random message fixed key. Somewhat ironic, but does that answer your question? I'm sure that's what you asked, but I was hard to misinterpret your question, I thought. But
something feels fishy because encryption can look.
Well, that's why
special for a fixed key, right? You can imagine encryption that somehow leak parts of the key and that's still okay.
Yeah, but I don't really care.
Special for a fixed message, something.
Well, so I care that the encryption. So remember, I use
he
the fact.
That
I assume that k is a good. I assume that k is a good distribution for my encryption. So I mean, so what I'm saying, whatever encryption you come up with, where this proof will fail, will not be a good, you know,
the
distribution for this encryption.
Yeah, the assumption is funny. It's not the proof. That
well,
this prime is electronic.
Well, the assumption is fine. So yeah, I didn't show you how to construct this extract. So let me put the lambda. Okay. That's an artificial auxiliary thing which is in the middle of the proof. I just need it for the proof.
So is this distribution for both the message and the key goes uniform, or whatever?
No. Key is fixed. So essentially, it has 2 to the n particular distributions.
So f prime is really a family of distribution for every k. I have a
yes. For every k,
prime.
I have a different distribution
and
C prime.
So it's extractable, you mean for every k,
right.
F
there
prime k is an extractable source.
Right, so it means there is a particular extractor which works for every particular distribution here. There
for
is
every k.
Yeah. So there is one guy which works. So let me give you lemma 2, which will kind of complete the deal. It just says that if B is exactly what we wanted it to be in our precondition originally, then this auxiliary source is B minus 2 log 1 epsilon extractable. Well, I don't have delta, but essentially if you just plug in here, you get exactly this and you lose this extra delta. So I'm kind of separating away where I use the security of encryption from where I used, as you will see, the correctness of encryption, because so far I didn't even use correctness of encryption, so I have to use it somewhere. So is it clear? So I claim that, I claim that once I prove this, well, this I already proved, once I prove this, I'm done, right, because you just plug it in. So let's prove this. Here I'm going to do something much slightly more general than I need, but it will kind of, just so that it will really show what we're using and what we're not. So I will say that the particular distribution x is b flat, if x is uniform over some space which I don't care about, if it's uniform on 2 to the b values. Right, so this is a flat distribution. And the point is, all distributions in this weird source are b flat, and this is the only place where I actually use the correctness. And more generally, that's why it will extend to all perfectly binding primitives. Yeah.
So actually, doesn't the fact that there is a decryption procedure, doesn't that immediately give you an extractor from this distribution, any distribution in the source S prime? I mean, if you just decrypt, don't you get a random string?
If I just decrypt, but where the sample,
but I have to know k.
I have an okay, I don't know k, yeah, that's the point, I don't know the key k. Yeah, I just given a sample, I don't know the key k. I mean, and presumably in a good encryption scheme, if you give me a key k, it's not going to be secure. So yeah, the difficulty
right,
is,
if I decrypt with a random key, I should, well, okay,
no, probably
I don't know,
but no, those are good questions. It's a little bit confusing. As you see, given the simplicity of the proof, The only reason I feel why people didn't do it early is A, they didn't care, well, which I hope some people probably care, and B, just because it's so simple that, you know, it just misses your attention or something, I don't know. But in any way, so all distributions in my family are B-flat, because you can kind of decrypt. So the third lemma is kind of more general version of lemma 2, just because, just to abstract away the necessary details. So if B is more than log n plus 2 log 1 of epsilon, any collection S prime of 2 to the n, well, there are 2 to the n distributions here, of 2 to the n B flat distributions is B minus 2 log 1 of epsilon extractable. Right? So you can say, wait a second, why don't we, it seems kind of fishy, why can't we just do deterministic extraction for all big sources? Well, the problem is there are many more big sources, and as you'll see, you cannot take a union bound quite completely. But you know, you can see that once you, well, you saw, I'll show it on the next slide, so I lied, I used 3 slides instead of 2 slides. But I claim that, you know, this lemma implies obviously lemma 2 and theorem 1. And now this lemma 3, we forget everything about encryption. Encryption is gone. We use both privacy and correctness of encryption, so we just need to prove this lemma. And the proof is, well, so let's just fix n so that I don't keep writing this guy all over again. And capital B is 2 to the B and capital L is 2 to the L, whatever this thing is. So essentially here is, it will explain why this non-uniform kind of extraction that we pick. I pick a random function f from whatever my space of ciphertext is to 0, 1 to the L. I mean, of course, I'll pick it at random and fix and show that this high probability just works. So first I claim that for any B-flat distribution x, Chernoff plus union bound implies that the statistical distance between f of x and ul, well, that's the probability over f, that the statistical distance, that essentially f is a bad extractor for x, is, you know, at most this number. I can roughly speak in this place. So this comes from this, so here, capital 2 to the capital L, I essentially pick arbitrary subset of my output space, and it suffices to show that the probability, you know, statistical distance is essentially the worst, you choose the worst subset of the output space, and you compare the probability that I go in here with, you know, with a natural probability. It's kind of the expectation. So I will take a union bound over all possible guys, over all possible subsets of the outputs. And for every particular one, essentially, I have the following thing. I have 2 to the B, or I have capital B balls. Those are essentially, you know, and I throw them into, you know, at random into L bins. So I have B balls, L bins, and I have some particular subset of the output. I want to say, what is the probability of the number of balls that go inside here is significantly far from the expectation. And this is just a simple Chernoff bound, even though in the original version I, for whatever reason, used a suboptimal one, so thanks for Salil for pointing this out. So using, you know, standard Chernoff bound, you get essentially this bound. I mean, it's not very complicated, but is it believable, right? So you just have this capital B balls, you throw them into L bills, you do it, and using our particular constraint on L, well, remember how we set L, I'm not putting it here, but remembering how we set L, it's easy to see that this is at most, you know, oh, there should be a minus sign, of course, I'm sorry. But I'm not going to edit it on the spot. So, but there should be a minus sign. So this is e to the minus guy. And then now I just say, okay, this is the probability of L on particular guy. Let's take the union bound of all guys. So there are 2 to the n distributions. Each of them, you know, my extractor fails on, you know, on each of them with this probability. So the probability it fails on any one of those things is at most this. And if you compare this, that's where this restrictions comes in. Because essentially at some point I just take union bound. But, you know, because of this restriction, this is again less than 1. So what this shows is that this probability less than 1, in fact, is actually overwhelming probability, but this probability, you know, at least with non-zero probability, a random f will be a good extractor for all of them. Right? So this is so far a theorem which is so, right, so I'll make it efficient in a second and so on, but this is essentially how you prove the existence. Right? So observations, so using the paper of Luca and Salil, it's enough. I mean, you can see that instead of using Chernoff bound, it's efficient to use Bilardi-Rompel inequality for the tails of, you know, n-ways independent functions. So 2-ways independence is not enough to kind of carry this union bound. But it turns out with high enough independence, which is n-ways independence, and, you know, n-ways independent functions can be computed in time polynomial in n, and samples in time polynomial in n, let's say they're polynomials of degree n, or whatever. It's enough. The previous analysis exactly goes through. I mean, just slightly different things, but you know, the final bound is exactly the same. So in particular, you get that if B is this, then any, so essentially the same lemma, but you show existentially that there exists an efficient extractor. For any family here, there exists an efficient extractor over here. And in the core, there is encryption is efficient, so is the extraction. Right? It extends to computational setting, as you can see from the result. You just, if you use computational security of encryption, you get pseudo-random bits. And perfect binding, if you see the only thing with the values in lemma 2 that you can decrypt, nobody ever runs a decryption algorithm. Well, it seems for seconds that it almost works, but so in this, in our case, we never run the decryption, so anything perfectly binding would be good enough. Alright, so proof of theorem 2. So let's see how far we get. Here I'm just restating theorem 2. So now back to Lucas' observation, as well, he said it for theorem 1, but it applies for theorem 2 as well. So I claim that it's sufficient to kind of, we can slope the quantifiers and prove the following things. That for B less than, so what does this say? It says that for B less than N, there exists a source and a specific encryption, which is good for this source, but you know, this source is not extractable. So I have to give you a source and the encryption. And I claim it's just sufficient for me to give you the encryption. Because I claim that for any of this, there exists a particular B-bit encryption for which a particular source, which I will define in a second, good sub B is not extractable. So rather than giving you a source and the encryption scheme, I will say, well, let me just give you an encryption scheme and let me define the source to be all distributions on which the encryption scheme is good. In fact, it's perfect. Right, so I will just give you a specific syntactic encryption of B-bits that encrypts and decrypts perfectly. And then I will say, you know what, my source now will be the best source I can hope for. These are all distributions of which it is perfect. So if you wish, I can turn it out. I can say, okay, let's say this is my source, this is my encryption. So by definition, you know, the encryption is perfect because for any particular key, this encryption is Shannon secure under this thing. But I just have to show that these guys are non-extractable, where epsilon is exactly this thing. So once again, essentially, I just need to construct an encryption scheme. The encryption scheme implicitly will define, you know, the source. And I only need to show that the source is not extractable. So I need to define, I don't know if I'm restating it. Okay, I guess I'm starting to do this small calculations. But is this clear? This is just a small little transition. So I'm saying
there exists an encryption scheme such that for every extractor, there exists a distribution that is good for the encryption but not good for the extractor.
Yeah, it's a lot of quantifiers, but yes, exactly. So, I mean, I should have put the game, but yeah, so this is what Lucas said. I give you one particular encryption scheme. You say, oh, you know what, I can extract. So you give me some extractor from the key, candidate extractor. I construct a specific distribution, which is perfect for the encryption, but kills your extractor. Right? So this is kind of the order of quantifiers. So so a little bit of notation. As it's not that complicated, so on this one slide, I will give you the overview of the proof. So as I said, let's just capital N. I don't want to write this 2 to the N and so on. Capital N is the number of keys, so the keys and bits. Capital B is the number of messages. So let me choose a number S satisfying this equation. Whatever it is, I mean, we'll see. So in particular, S is, roughly speaking, N is S to the B. Right? So in particular, S is greater than this. And you can see that if you look at our parameters, the relation on N and B, which was on the previous slide, if you plug it in, you can see that this is greater than B. So what is this S? S is going to be the number of our ciphertexts. So it starts to be a little bit technical, but my point is the following. So this is a nice bullet that will hopefully explain it. So here is the point. So this is wrong. So this should be capital B. So my message space will be numbers from 1 to B, capital B. Okay, so this is my message space. My ciphertext will be numbers from 1 to S. So there are B messages, S ciphertext. And kind of as a sanity check, this just shows that the number of ciphertexts is at least equal to the number of messages. Which is kind of good, because if you want to uniquely decrypt, the parameters better be that the number of ciphertexts is more than the number of messages. And that's exactly where the constraint will come in. I mean, we already kind of used it here. And the key K is going to be all B tuples of ciphertexts. So intuitively, I will switch to the blackboard very soon. Well, let me actually turn it on already. But intuitively, I have this S ciphertext from 1 to S, and essentially all possible distinct B tuples of ciphertext, ordered B tuples, if you wish, you can order them. You know, there will be a key for each one of those B tuples. Right? So for each ordered B tuple of ciphertext, there will be a key, which is kind of natural. Why? Because this is my encryption scheme. So the encryption scheme is essentially given any key, which is a B tuple of the ciphertext, and given the message, What is the encryption of the message? It's the M's ciphertext, right? So essentially, what I'm saying is I view keys, my keys, as essentially I turn it around. Usually you define a key and then you compute encryption of the message under this key. Here, the key is right away encryption of one, encryption. So it's like my key is encryption of one under this key, encryption of two under this key, encryption of three under this key, and so on. So my key tells you right away what the encryption, so essentially the key right away defines the encryption via this trivial relation. Sorry? Yeah, codebook and decryption is, you know, because these guys are unique, the only thing I restrict that the things are different, that the bituples, all the ciphertexts are different in this bituple, and the decryption is kind of optional. So more or less, what am I doing? I'm just saying I'm defining the most broad encryption scheme. I decided on the number of ciphertexts S, and I say any, you know, S tuple, any ordered tuple corresponds to a key. There is a key which can explain any ordered sequence of ciphertexts. Right, so this is kind of the widest possible encryption. Why am I doing the widest possible encryption? Because it makes it easier for me to fix the extractor. I want to give myself as many options as possible, as many keys as possible to kill, 7. I started at 12 or 5. All right.
Okay.
So you haven't, there are no distributions yet on keys.
Well, I mean, they're implicitly defined. The key, the distributions are, all the distributions for which this encryption scheme is perfect. So my distributions, as I said, that's why I put this previous thing, these are all the distributions on which this particular encryption scheme is perfect. And now I take any extractor, so now I have a candidate extractor, and I want to kill it. So there are two cases. So the first case, I can say, whatever this extractor assumes there exists, I mean, this is a big assumption, but I'm just saying this is the easy case. So the trivial case is assume for this particular extractor, there is what we call a zero monochromatic perfect distribution. So there exists a perfect distribution K. It's complicated to understand what a perfect distribution is, but it's just a distribution for this encryption. There exists a perfect distribution K for which, you know, for every particular, so what I want to say,
We should think of the extractor as a coloring.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. So you should think of the extractor as a coloring of edges. So essentially, well, edges is hyper edges. So essentially, every ordered bituple is going to be colored 0, 1. And I want to say that assume there is a distribution which is completely concentrated on keys which extract to 0. So that's what I say, 0, 1. So assume there is a perfect distribution such that all non-zero things are actually all things with non-zero max extract to 0. In this case, I'm done. I mean, this is like a trivial assumption. I'm just saying, this is the distribution which kills your extractor. So it's a perfect distribution by assumption and kills your extractor. So, and we can fix it. So the difficult case is to assume that no such zero monochromatic perfect distributions exist. So that's a big, and the main lemma, kind of, I will show that in assuming that there are no, the lack of trivial proofs of the theorem, right, so this is a trivial proof of the theorem, the lack of trivial proofs of the theorem will imply that there exists a distribution. If there are non-zero monochromatics, then there is a distribution which is almost entirely one monochromatic. So there exists a distribution K prime such that extractor, probability extractor on K prime material is at most, you know, it happens to be, the number will be very clean, P square over S. And if you plug in this particular bound on S, you get exactly the bound that we want. Just trust me on that. You plug this, and this is exactly the bound that we want, which is, you know, this number is very close to zero. So number of ciphertexts is much more than even the square of the number of messages in this case. So this is the thing, and if you plug this in, you get this thing. So this is kind of the main lemma, essentially the main lemma, which I'll just give you 2 minutes kind of thing, and then looks like the good news is, you'll see what the good news is. So if you cannot fix the extractor to zero by trivial means, right? I mean, if you can, you're done. Then there exists a perfect distribution such that the probability extraction is zero is at most B square over S.
So then you fix the extractor.
Yeah, the extractor is fixed. For any extractor, I will give you a perfect distribution. It has to be a perfect one of the legal distributions, for which this extractor is very likely to be zero. So the fact that there is no way to trivially fix the extractor to zero means that there are a lot of keys which map to one. Because there must be a lot of keys which map to one if you cannot fix it. And if there are a lot of keys that map to one, the problem is I have to give, you know, to kind of assemble them together in a way that gives me a perfect distribution on this encryption scheme. So this is kind of the difficult part. And essentially, so proof of, I guess, theorem to prime, or this main lemma is, so
can I go now? Can I go now?
So this is a good question. So essentially, I was going to give you some boring proof on the board, and maybe I'll just give you a few words about it. But yeah, essentially what I was going to say is that, you know, don't go the answer to this question, but I'll let you go in 2 minutes. So we'll just prove, I'll give you an idea how to prove this thing on the board, and, you know, and then we'll conclude. So. All right, so maybe we'll just turn it, I mean, I will not try it much, I have 2 minutes, and I'll try to respect, or unless people want me to. So maybe what I will give you, so this is kind of the main lemma. Oh, I see, okay. What I'm going to do is to give you the idea that if there is no monochromatic distribution,
This must not be distracting at all.
Is
it included in 2 minutes?
Yeah, now I can take another 15 seconds. Looks like I won't be able to say much, but let me just. Okay. So, I want to use. The difficulty is to use the fact that there are no zero monochromatic distributions. It's kind of very strange how we use this fact. So, let me just give you the case for b equals 1. So for b equals 1, you can view the keys as ordered edges that go from encryption to 0 to encryption of 1. So this actually proof follows trivially. I'm giving you the proof of Donnie Spencer. This proof is much more complicated. But I will just give you an idea how to do it, at least for b equals 1. And in our case, we had to use some duality of linear programming and some other stuff, which is fun, and I prepared it, but of course, you're lucky not to see it. So, but in this case, for b equals 1, the keys are, if you wish, ordered edges. They kind of go from encryption to 0 to encryption of 1. So what does it mean that there is no zero monochromatic distribution? So for example, let's look at the uniform distribution over these keys. This is a perfect encryption. It's like a kind of a one-time head. So in this case, b equals 1, so I'm constructing encryptions of 1 bit, which are not extractable. I mean, this is already well done in my paper with Joel Spencer, but so that's the only thing I'm going to give you just kind of an idea of how to prove such things. So this is a perfect distribution. So this, since this is non-monochromatic, at least one of these edges extracts to 1. So for any particular 2-cycle, I mean, under my assumption, at least one of the guys extract to 1. So let's leave only the guys which extract to 1. And if both of them extract to 1, I will sacrifice even one of them.
Why?
So let's look. Yeah.
Why is it follow that for any 2 of them, one edge is 1,
so that it's a perfect encryption. Because think about this is a one-time pass. Essentially,
it wasn't perfect. It was just that it was not zero monochromatic.
So here, what I'm saying is there is no monochromatic. Oh, sorry, perfect. Sorry, correct. So of course I want to say is there. Yeah. So my assumption is there is no zero monochromatic perfect distribution. So this is a perfect distribution. It is like a one-time pass on 2 particular things. So, and the assumption that, so because it's perfect, and because I assume that it's not zero monochromatic, at least one of the edge extracts to 1 and the other edge extracts to 0. So let's, remove the 0 guys. And let's actually, essentially, for every 2 edges, let's just draw whichever direction extracts to 1. If both of them, I just will draw one of them. So if you can imagine this as a tournament. So any 2 guys, so there are, what is the number of subtracts? Like the sum number of subtracts is S. So there are H, S choose 2 matches, and for each match there is a winner and a loser. Right, you can imagine it. So this is kind of a tournament. And there is a simple theorem in combinatorics, cute, but this is every tournament has a Hamiltonian pass. So there exists essentially a way to order guys, such as guy 1 beat guy 2, guy 2 beats guy 3, and so on. Possibly guy n loses to guy number 1, but there is a way to order it. It's not very hard to show, I won't show it, but it's easy to show. I can show it in 2 minutes. It's easy. So now, what I'm saying is, I have like now a Hamiltonian cycle, or Hamiltonian pass with all ones here. Everything extracts to 1, so I complete it. So this guy, I don't know. For all I know, maybe it extracts to 0. But it claims that this is a perfect distribution. Because if you look at it for every particular thing, it's equally likely that it's a tail versus it's a head. So every cycle kind of is a good distribution. So I give you a Hamiltonian pass such that only one out of S, so let's make uniform distribution over this case. So I give you a Hamiltonian pass such that at most one out of S guys extract to zero. So here I will get the probability is one over S. Remember, my tanks is B square over S, and which I proved even something easier. So this is kind of the idea, but of course in this case it was very easy to understand because one bit guys, they just, you know, kind of edges and we understand graph theory very well. In this case, you have B-bit encryption, so in this case B is a relatively large number, and this kind of ordered hyper edges are like really weird. And I wanted to prove this theorem for a while. In fact, we made a conjecture with Joel Spencer. We thought that encryption would not imply extraction for essentially B very, very high. But the problem is, you know, B equals 2, it was very ugly to work with these hyper edges. And that's kind of the approach that got us stuck for a while. And then Carl came along, and he is an expert in linear algebra. We just had a totally different approach. And we said, look, let's not just, you know, worry about these graphs, they're like too complicated. So what we did, we had a linear algebraic characterization of the fact that there are no zero monochromatic distribution. So translated to here, what our result would say is the following. I just translated to here. I will say that there are numbers, real numbers, y1 by s, with the following property. So in this case, s is a number of ciphertexts. So whatever linear characterization we do for this case, translated to this trivial case, which I proved to you anyway, the linear characterization, linear algebra characterization will say the following. That there are real numbers y1, ys, which are outside of my control. But the only thing I know about them is that if yi, is less than yj, then extractor applied to kij, so remember, keys are like ordered tuples, is 1. So essentially, the fact that there exists no zero monochromatic distribution gave me the following kind of very weird characterization in this case. It told me that there are some real numbers which are outside of my control, and they came from some duality of linear programming which, you know, is outside of my control. But essentially, there are such numbers with a property that if yi is less or equal than yj, for any a, like for any hij, for any key, which is, let's say, ij, if yi is less than yj, I knew that extractor extracts 1. And why is it kind of outside of my control? But now, how to translate this characterization to this? As I said, and this is kind of what I want, because I want a characterization which tells me that keys are 1. Right? So there are a lot of kind of 1 keys. And here I can say, well, look, any real numbers can be sorted. So let's just sort real numbers. Let's say there is a permutation pi such that y of pi of 1 is less than y of pi of 2 and so on, less of pi of s. And let me create now exactly this Hamiltonian thing. So I will just make go here, you know, go from pi 1 to pi 2 and so on, and go back, and because, the other way around, whatever the sign is, right? And then I knew, because I sorted in this case, all those guys extract to 1. This guy, I don't know what it does, maybe it extracts to 0, maybe not. And then I can approve this theory. So, translated to this one bit case, essentially this is what we showed, but you can see all aspects kind of the proof. So, you don't see the main one, this is kind of the main lemma. But essentially, the proof shows that the fact that there are no zero monochromatic distributions. So what does it mean? You can write kind of a linear program, because the encryption, I'm almost done. So the encryption constraint is, just the fact that something is a perfect encryption is a bunch of linear equations. The only, essentially you have a probability distribution. And also this probability distribution defines encryption, a perfect encryption, just a bunch of inequalities, The only problem is that the weights have to be non-negative. So there is one kind of inequality. That's why it's equivalent to linear programming rather than a linear system. And we want to say, is this system satisfiable? Is this linear program satisfiable? Right? And there is kind of a very nice characterization, due to Farkas. There is something called Farkas lemma, which says, if something is unsatisfiable, there must be a reason for it. And this reason comes from this kind of coefficients, such that something is less than zero, something is greater than zero. So essentially, this is a duality of linear programming. It says that if the linear program is unsatisfiable, there must be a reason for it. This reason will give us these weights. And unsatisfiable means, that's my assumption. There are no zero monochromatic perfect distribution. So I write, system of equations for all, the system of equations for the probabilities corresponding to keys which extract to zero. And I say, well, can I satisfy it or not? If I can, then it's like, I'm trivially done. If I cannot, there must be a reason for it. And this reason gives me a bunch of weights. And then when you translate this bunch of weights to the whole, you look at the specific matrix. It's a very, the encryption scheme is very specific. It's very structured. So you look at the encryption matrix, and You get some characterization which is similar to this one, but more complicated. So for b with k, it's more complicated. For b equals 1, the characterization reduces to this. Notice this is actually more, not surprisingly, this by itself is more powerful than this. Because here, it's true that I only use successive edges, but here kind of shows that for any I and j, you know, if it's less than 0, it's actually blue. I don't need end up, I'm almost done, so yeah. So anyway, this is all I wanted to say.